Thank you all for hospitality and nice time, as always, I have here. I'd like to tell you about, a little curiosity we discovered with Michele Arzano a few months ago. And of course, it's about a Unruh effect without space-time, but in a sense, this title is a bit of exaggeration, because if you really want to dig up, you'll find some trace of space-time in what I'm going to say. But what I want to emphasize here is that there is a way of actually describing the Unruh effect in terms of some basic structures which do not involve space-time. Okay, so let me start with the basics, which everybody knows. We have the black hole thermodynamics, which is a source of, it's a continuous source of puzzlement and problems. And the history goes that Bekenstein suggested that there is an entropy of black hole, which is proportional to its area. And it was confirmed by Hawking when he discovered that black holes indeed, that means that the black holes can be considered as to be a thermodynamical system. It was confirmed by Hawking, who actually discovered that the black hole radiates at some given temperature. And it was realized to me almost immediately that there are some puzzles, and these puzzles still stay. And there are some puzzling aspects. We don't know really what are the degrees of freedom that are responsible for the black hole entropy. There is a problem with unitarity of black hole evaporation. So there is there are still some deep problems concerning black hole thermodynamics. And but the crucial point, if you really think about this problem, the crucial point of the black hole thermodynamics, these puzzles, is the quantum temperature perceived by accelerated observed, but not by inertial one. So there is a temperature associated with the horizon, and it was Unruh who was who motivated by Hawking discovery that this Unruh paper came a year after Hawking's, and Unruh realized that if you are an observer moving with a constant acceleration, so uniform accelerating observer with a constant acceleration I moving in Minkowski space, then this observer will associate, well, we will see the, we will find himself or herself submerged in the bath of thermal radiation. And the question we asked ourselves in this paper and what I want to tell you about is, what is the universal structure behind the Unruh temperature? The standard derivation that everybody knows is that you start with some field theory on Rindler wedge, and then you compare the Minkowski vacuum with the Rindler vacuum, and you find that Minkowski vacuum, that the Rindler vacuum, sorry, the Minkowski vacuum from the perspective of the Rindler observer is actually a thermal state. So this is the field theoretical derivation. However, we discovered that it's possible actually to make this derivation kind of more refer to more basic notions than the notion of quantum field. So what I want to tell you about is essentially to tell you that if I have a notion of associated with the geometrical notion of null boundary, we can actually there is a quantum state and I would like to really to find this thermal state in the setup that's as minimal as possible. So the minimal setting consists of group theoretical ingredients associated with the symmetries of space-time, with the boundary, and as a matter of fact, I will see it. Essentially geometry of the line and the half-line. So in principle, there is no space-time, there is no metric, and there are almost no quantum fields. So how this, so what is the setup? So the starting point is no boundary, a Nernst surface, flat Nernst surface in Minkowski space. And assume that this flat space, well, I just need it to be local. So I don't need the surface to be global. Suppose I have a local surface in light-like surface in Minkowski spacetime. So locally it's just flat. And suppose it's placed on the TX plane. And there is a normal to the surface. The surface essentially splits the line, which is orthogonal to it, into two halves. And this is the basic part, and this is the basic point of this analysis. Because if you have a line split into two halves, there are two, essentially you can think of two translations. One translation, which is the ordinary translation of the whole line, and the second translation, which is, well, it will be later denoted by P, and another denoted by R, which generates translation on the half line. Then one considers some plane waves associated with this translation operators, which are eigenfunctions of the translations P and R. And then the coexistence of these two translation generators actually is the key, as you will see, is essentially the key to Unruh effect. So let me go to specific calculation. I have the one interesting, a little bit curious thing about the whole construction is that you would think that if you are in the flat space, it's everything that's interesting is actually covered the interesting symmetries are covered by Poincaré algebra, but yet it turns out that in this construction, in a kind of non-trivial way, you need to add to Poincaré algebra, you need to add the dilation operator. So in fact, we are not considering the Poincaré algebra, but we're considering the Poincaré-Weyl algebra. Okay, how it looks like. So the sector which is relevant, which is the sector which is, you know, which is relevant for a TX plane, consists of the two translation generators, PT and PX, and the boost. There is one boost N and one dilation operator, and the algebra is like this. All right, so let me actually take half of these generators and form, form the Lightcon generators, one that I call P and another that I call R. That's just combination of the P is a combination of translations and R is a combination of dilation and boost. Well, you can easily compute that the commutator and the only commutator for this algebra consists of two elements and it has non-trivial commutator in the sense that it's the simplest non-trivial Lie algebra you can think of, right? That's the only algebra of two generators. And, this is the simplest object you can think of. And the point I would like to make is that just using this algebra and the associated group, I can actually derive the Unruh effect. So what I will do, I will actually start, doing mathematics using the group representation theory, and then I will turn to physics just to explain how this mathematical results translates can be actually understood in terms of the Unruh temperature or Unruh effect. But probably, and this is my hope, that probably this representation theory of this algebra or this group might be useful and interesting also in other circumstances. Well, since this is the simplest algebra, the mathematicians have a special name for this group. The group is called AX plus B group. It's a group of transformation which consists of two elements, A and B. which moves x into ax plus b, where a is just this a positive number, b is a real number. So if you think of it, you may think that this algebra is essentially the algebra of the two translations that I've been starting with, because if a is 1, then x is just translated by b. So this is a normal translation. And if b is 0, then there is a scale transformation, but for positive x's, the scale transformation, actually the orbit of the scale transformation is a whole R plus, which means that you can think of this as indeed as a group of two translations. One being the translation of R, and the second being a translation of R plus. Okay, so that these two transformations. This is a very simple group. It's not an abelian group, but it's still very simple. The representation theory is known. And essentially, the representation theory boils down to the following representation. I take a state, which is labeled by positive number k, which actually can be, I mean, from the perspective of quantum field theory, you can call them, as you will see, they naturally appear to be the positive energy state. So this is a positive energy of the one-dimensional state. And the translation of these operators act in the following way. The translation operator multiplies this by a phase, which is exactly what the translation operator does in momentum space. And this other generator, so another group action, multiplies the k by the positive number, which is defined in this. So for infinitesimal generators, p is a momentum operator, just a standard one, and r acts, well, this kind of dilatation, but you know the infinitesimal form of dilatation operator is this one, with k being positive.
So in terms of the original geometry, this x is one of the. Can you think of it as one of the null coordinates, and you're just translating
yes.
and dilating one of the null coordinates, mm-hmm. while leaving the other one
yeah.
intact?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But at this moment, I completely forget about the construction, you know, with this null screen and the orthogonal direction. I just stick myself to this orthogonal direction, okay. And we will turn to the physical picture later on. Well. I can form something which I call the function on the momentum space with the action of these generators like this. And then I can use the Fourier transform to transform to the position space. And I can form the object, which is a function on position space, which is expansion in the basis of the eigenfunction of translation operator, like this, which I can write in the field theoretical language in this way. But at this point, I'm not quantizing yet, so this is just a formal, just to introduce the function a star a of k. And a star of k.
So what does the little plus mean?
Sorry?
What does a little plus subindex mean on the left?
Oh, plus means that k are just positive.
Okay.
So because I started with a positive energy state, I take a complex conjugate and I do the Fourier transform. Okay, and now I can calculate what is the action of this generators, translation and dilation on the state. So this is the standard translation operator, and this is a dilation operator. Okay. Well, so far, what I did was to consider the representation of this algebra in the basis in which this operator P was diagonal. So I started with the positive energy state, so to say, on which the translation, P translation, act diagonally. and I constructed the representation. I did the Fourier transform, and I constructed the space-time and space-time functional space-time field. Now, of course, there is another way. So I can represent this object, this algebra, on the states which are being diagonalized by R. And as a matter of fact, it is known that the relation between states k plus and the states omega, which will be diagonalized by R, is by something which is called Mellin transform. And so I construct omega is a combination, is a Mellin transform of the k state. So omega state is the one which is diagonalized by R, which is a state which will be on which the generator of the another translation, this half-aligned translation, is actually acting diagonally. And, well, we had the representation on the energy, so positive energy state chi, which was with the standard with the translations being associated with P, and R act in a kind of a strange way. Here we have an opposite situation, up to the minus sign that somehow happens to be convenient. R is acting diagonally on omega state, and P, well, is acting on a kind of a weird way on omega state. So we have now the representation, and then, so I can actually construct the same omega representation. I can define, so starting with omega representation, I can actually find, again, the space-time field, which can be written in this form. All right. So what do I have? Well, I have the space-time field, which is constructed, or the space-time function, which is constructed once in terms of eigenstates of the standard translation operator, and I have the same field constructed in terms of the eigenstates of the half-line translation operators. And because this is the same field, or the same function, I can actually associate one with another, which means that there must be a relation, which is essentially, you know, this is essentially the relation for Bogolyubov coefficients, which is the relation between the coefficient that appear in terms of the R translation, or half-aligned translation, with the coefficients which are in terms which are related to the full-line translation. This is the relation, and actually, if you remember the derivation of Unruh effect, this is exactly, or the black hole radiation, this is exactly the relation that you encounter at some point of the derivation, which is because this is the which is essentially the equation which tells you what the Bogolyubov coefficients for transition from one picture to another are. Now what I can do is to ask myself what is going to be the quantum theory associated with this picture, and in order to do that, I can just quantize. So I assume the following quantization condition for the coefficients that I have in the expansion of the field, which I identify with creation annihilation operator, and the same I do for another set of creation annihilation operators. I define vacua like this, and then I can actually ask myself what is the number density of the number of B particles in the A vacuum, which turns out to be, not surprisingly, just the thermal distribution. Okay, so let me summarize what happened here. We started with the algebra, which being an algebra of the group of two translations, one which was the a translation, the ordinary translation on the line. Another was the translation on the half line. We constructed representation theory for this, for representation theory of this algebra, and then we found that after quantization, if I have a state associated with the translations on the line and the state associated with the translation on the half line, then the number of the states of the, well, now I can call them Rindler states in the states associated with a line, which I can call Minkowski states, is just given by thermal distribution. Something is, however, not right yet, and we really need to go back to physics. Well, what is not right is that if I look at this algebra, the dimension of P might be anything, so I can indeed say that P is a translation operator. So I can make the dimension of the P to be one to be inverse length, as it should be. However, as it stands, the dimension of R must be dimensionless. So everything mathematically everything is fine, but physically we still need to work a little bit. Well, we can actually change the dimension of R by multiplying R with a scale which is of dimension of inverse length, and then the algebra takes this form. But then the question arises, what is A? The algebra is essentially the same, I just rescaled the generators, so nothing special, nothing really happens. But the question arises, if I do that, so indeed this operator AR has the right dimension, the question is, what is A, and what is the physical or geometrical interpretation of this parameter? Okay, so let's try to figure it out. Well, of course it's related to acceleration, as we expect, but the story is a little bit, it's kind of funny, and I think that many people know that, but it came to me when I realized what's happening. Actually, it came to me as a kind of a surprise. So suppose I have a two-dimensional, Minkowski space. This is the orbit, this is the world line of accelerated observer. It's governed by the scale 1 over a squared. And then the Lorentz transformations. And what Lorentz transformations do, well, you know, this orbit is nothing but the orbit of Lorentz transformations. Right? This is something that you know, because you really need to go from one inertial observer to an inertial observer moving with a little bit different speed, you need to employ the Lorentz transformation. And this is one of the derivation of this, is actually by employing Lorentz transformation one after another. So the fact that this is an orbit of Lorentz transformation is not really surprising. Now the question is, what is the transformation that actually moves you from one orbit to another? Well, so the Lorentz orbit is fixed by this parameter A. So how I change the parameter A? Well, I change it by a dilatation. If I multiply tau, t, and x by a number, then that it's exactly equivalent to multiplying A by the inverse number. Okay? So there is the dilatation transformation that actually moves you from one orbit to another, which means that if you think about the Rindler wedge is exactly defined to be a set, well, it can be built from the orbits of Lorentz transformation and dilatation, right? So basically the picture is this. This is the Rindler space, and I can actually parameterize the Rindler space, and this is the standard parameterization that you see in the textbook. This is parameter eta and the parameter xi, but these parameters are nothing but the value of Lorentz boost and the value of the dilatation. So in fact, you can construct this wedge in Minkowski space just by from orbits just by using orbits of dilatation and Lorentz transformations. Or boosts in this case, because there are no other Lorentz transformations. All right. So what's really happening? I have a generators PT and PX, which generate the translation Minkowski space. And now I'm returning to this picture that I had at the very beginning, this algebra, this Weyl Poincaré algebra. But now it actually gets a nice meaning. The P and PX, PT and PX, generate translation in Minkowski space. And the operators AN and AD are generating translations in Rinder space. So that's why this construction of the line and half line in terms of the AX plus B group is essentially associated with the Poincaré-Weyl symmetry. Okay, and this is the algebra, and this is exactly the algebra that I already showed you. The only difference is that since I would like to interpret these operators N and D as translations, I need to add the scale just to make the dimensions right. I'm afraid. I'm really closing. So I think it's going to be a pretty short seminar. I'm sorry for that. So let me. Perhaps I speed up a little bit too much. So.
Can I ask a question about
that? Yes, sure. Sure, we have plenty of time. okay, so let me go.
So are they only the generators at the, like if you're sitting at the corresponding to that acceleration, or do they make sense over all of the space?
If I have my definition of, let me go back. This is a word line of accelerating observer, right? And each accelerating observer is defined in terms of a particular acceleration piece. The value of the acceleration he's accelerating. So this is the one observer. The question is, so for any single observer, the observer word line is essentially the orbit of the Lorentz group. Now I'm asking, and here what I'm doing, I'm actually trying to find the natural coordinates of Rindler wedge just by asking myself how to change from one observer to another. On the other hand, If I take this algebra, I understand this algebra as an algebra associated with a particular observer, which is moving with acceleration A. So this A gives the scale of the translation, which is associated with a particular observer moving with a particular acceleration. As I will see in a moment, This scale actually translates into temperature immediately, right? Because in this derivation that I had before, there was no real scale, so the expression was essentially had wrong dimension. But here, if I associate this scale with the generator, I'll find that the temperature is actually depending on the scale. And it depends exactly in a way that Unruh temperature does for the accelerating observer.
But I guess I was just asking if, say, you took that generator with that A, but then you wanted to act at a world line that was at acceleration B, does it just act in a way that you wouldn't expect as a dilatation there or as the wrong type of translation there?
Let me think. Well, that's a good question. I don't have an immediate answer except that it actually works. Let me continue. I will think a bit, and then I'll try to answer a question. Since the K is the something that we actually call the K representation, or the representation in which the translations were diagonal, the whole line translations were diagonal, and omega, which was the basis that diagonalized the half line translations. Well, essentially what we did, we been comparing Minkowski and Rinder observers, and we found the thermal distribution of the number, of the quanta and Rindler observers, which Rindler observers in Minkowski space. But now I know that I need to give the scale, so I need to add the scale so as to make the R a real translation with the right dimension. And then when you repeat the calculation, so instead of the eigenvalues of the operator, R, you change it to the operator AR and do the translations, do the calculation, then you find that this temperature is of that sort. Okay, to answer a question, well, I think it's a little bit tricky because you see, well, there are two ways you derive Unruh effect. The one way is the field theoretical way. So you actually construct a quantum field theory in Rindler space, and then you construct a quantum field theory in Minkowski space. You take the wave functions. It's not completely trivial to find the field. You find the field in Minkowski space and in Rindler space, and then you compare it. If you look at the original, derivation of Unruh, you see that you really need to come to analytically continue the field from the Rindler wedge to the whole Minkowski space. Then you compare the field, you find the Bogoliubov coefficients, and you find the thermal distribution. This is one way. Which essentially is telling you that the field theory, that the vacuum of the field theory of Minkowski is a thermal space with a thermal state with respect to the field theory on Rindler space, right? There is another derivation, so there is another way of seeing the Rindler effect, which is this Unruh de Witt detector, in which you move your detector, you accelerate your detector in Minkowski space, and then you see what the detector sees. And then you find that actually the detector sees the thermal state. But these two derivations are not, that are related, but I don't quite see any, kind of a close relation between them, or the logical relation between them. They confirm the same fact, but they're actually quite different. So the derivation I have here, of course, I'm using this terminology of Unruh, of Rindler observer and Minkowski observer, but essentially this is a simplified stripped to the bone derivation of the first kind, of this field theoretical kind. So I'm not having really an observer which carries some detector or some thermometer and moves and is accelerating in Minkowski space, and then he sees his device actually showing some temperature, which is proportional to the temperature. I mean, people use in describing Unruh effect, just relying on this field theoretical derivation, they use to talk about about Unruh observer and Minkowski observer. But this is justified, as far as I understand, only by the second derivation, which actually is complementary, some kind of complementary to it. Okay. But perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps there is a better understanding of the relation between the two. All right. So what is the big picture? Well, if you, well, you know, the Unruh effect, so the very last part of the of what I was telling you, is just a particular example of the usual representation theory of AX plus B group. And in a sense, the geometrical setup that I started with, which is essentially, you know, the splitting of a space into two halves by, you know, by the light-like surface, is probably more general than that. And can be, so this representation theory of AX plus B and that the thermal structure that that actually results from it is probably useful, might be probably useful in the in different contexts than just Unruh effect. So there might be instances in which this representation must be might be of use. Well, I wouldn't be myself if I actually didn't say that. Well, you know, there is this probably already 20-year long investigation of the probable of the possible relevance of quantum deformation in the context of quantum gravity, and there are some results indicating that at least that the deformation indeed captures some effect of quantum gravity. So, for example, at least in the simplified context, you may justify the claim that the symmetries of flat quantum space-time is indeed described not by Poincaré algebra but by its quantum deformation. So the natural way, if you believe this kind of reasoning, a natural thing to consider is actually to deform this algebra and try to find out what are the, so I can deform the algebra, I can find the representation theory of deformed algebra, and then I actually try to find out what would be the correction, so how would this, so derived Unruh effect be modified if the deformations are involved. The theory of Hopf algebra, or the deformation of this AX plus B group, or the algebra is, because it's a very simple algebra, that the theory is well known, so it's actually something that we are going to do in the near future. I think the one thing that probably it's worth contemplating is the Jacobson derivation of Einstein equation as equation of states. And if you look at the Jacobson paper, I think what is pretty obvious is that he can really nicely justify the entropy and the energy. So his construction is essentially that he has a screen and he has some flow of energy through the screen. He associates energy with the area. And then if he assumes that the temperature associated with, you know, that he uses in construction is just Unruh temperature, he gets essentially Einstein equations as the equation of coming from the first law of thermodynamics. But the point which seems to be kind of in this derivation, I mean, I always had an impression that the weakest point of this derivation is really something about the temperature. So he really puts the temperature by hand. And I think that perhaps this reasoning makes it possible to better understand this derivation and to find a more natural way that the Unruh temperature actually emerges in this context, or it's necessary to derive the Einstein equation from thermodynamics. And I think that's it. What I wanted to say. I'm sorry. I thought it's going to take me longer, but. Well, it took me out what it took me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Rob. Then you have time for questions.
Okay. So, as I understand the usual field theory under calculation, this is something that I can make sense of in free field theory.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if I wanted to turn on interactions, then I probably would move on pretty quickly. But, you know, but at the group theory level, I could imagine that I have interacting theory that still carries representations.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yet, what you did made it look like you were just an only single particle series.
I did it for a single particle state. So I did it for the, so the, if you look at the paper, which is more detailed than what I said here, we actually did the explicit calculation for the vacuum and for the single particle states as well.
So let me ask the question. So, mm-hmm. Suppose you had a theory that was weakly interacting.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it's fair to say that you expect that multi-particle states would come into the calculation.
Mm-hmm.
So is it that, from the representation theory point of view, is it just that you're looking at some small representations of the symmetry, and there are others that would come in a more general physical situation?
I'm not completely sure I understand the question. I mean, surely I can actually do, because we've been comparing the one particle states, for example, in one representation and another, and then we actually calculated what is the how you can translate one particle state in one representation to the one particle state in another representation. The same for vacuum. I think that, but I'm not sure if it's your question. I'm absolutely sure that you can do exactly the same thing for a multi-particle states. So you can use the same representation theory. And well, given also that you control the creation annihilation operators algebra, and you know what is the relation between, you know, the creation annihilation operators, I think that it's just a pretty straightforward business to you know, to relate multiple.
Went to the extreme where there's no particle. Is there still another effect?
Sorry?
If I go to the extreme limit where there's no particle, is there still a sense in which there's an under effect?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
What was the question?
The question is, if I go to string theory, right?
Well, if I went to strong coupling.
Mm-hmm. You said strong coupling. Sorry. that was kind of a misunderstanding. Right. Well, you're string theory, so I always think that your question will go up. So if I go to strong coupling, well, I don't know. So if I go to the quantum field, to the real interacting quantum field theory, what's going to happen? I don't know. I don't know.
So there is another derivation of the under effect that you didn't mention, which just goes by the Euclidean path integral.
That's true.
Which, and in that one, it basically just comes from the periodicity of the rotation in Euclidean space corresponding to the...
Right. Right. Yes, you're right.
It doesn't assume anything about recoupling. That one, in principle, is true for interacting theory.
Very good. So then the question is, how does this fit into that?
That's some of the same ingredients. In other words, the boost is the thing that is sort of playing the important role. It basically just follows from this.
That's right. So it should be, it's probably, says yes, I think it's a very nice comment. Thank you. Because it seems to me that then this path integral result, or, you know, thermal path integral result, should probably be also rely on the Euclidean version of the same algebra.
And I just wanted to add to Will's comment. I mean, there's the very oldest derivation of this is actually from people doing sort of more rigorous quantum field theory, which is by Bisignano and Dichmann. What?
Bisignano
and Dichmann. And I think it's the same essential ideas, although I've never read the paper. But what they prove is that with respect to the accelerating observer, in other words, the isometry given by the boost killing vector, the Rindler observer, if you like, that the Minkowski, the state, the quantum field theory state, which is the Minkowski vector, satisfies the KMS condition.
Yes, that's right. Sure.
And that it's claimed, within the confines of that approach to field theory, it's claimed to be completely independent of interactions or non-interactions.
Yeah.
Just want to follow up a little bit on this discussion. I think when you talk about representation theory, you have basically an assumption underlying, right? Unitary representation.
That's true.
Because if I allow other kinds of representation,
that's true, of course.
A different result.
Of course.
I just want to remark that all of these different derivations, they're essentially connected in the sense that you're assuming that there's nothing happening on the horizon, so that you really can make a mapping of unitary representations.
That's right.
Which is perfectly reasonable in Minkowski space,
mm-hmm.
but might not apply, for example, to the black hole. That's a different question.
That's right. So I understand that your comment boils down to the question: to what extent you can actually trust this near the horizon geometry of black hole, right? Because
I mean, if you think of representation theory in the way structured your talk, the question is: what representation should I allow?
Mm-hmm.
Right. For these,
So I agree that one of the implicit assumptions is that nothing really weird happening, at the point when we were splitting the line into two, right?
I mean, over the years, I think I have seen papers, I can't remember offhand, but people have questioned that assumption about whether, I mean, they've just mathematically shown that if you assume something different from that bifurcation point,
mm-hmm.
you will get a different result. You don't necessarily get the answer result. So I think all these derivations, especially the Euclidean one, are connected to the regularity of the horizon.
That's right. That's right. Sure. Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
I guess it's also from this Euclidean perspective, it's not totally clear to me where the dilatation comes in. Because the Euclidean derivation, it really only cares that you have a Boost symmetry. I don't know, do you know why you should postulate things should also represent? Is it
I will have to look at it, right? Because, offhand, I don't see any, I couldn't see really how this algebra is related to the, or Euclidean version of this algebra is to be related with this path integral approach. But I think that because this path integral approach is so fundamental, right, it's so simple, it must be somehow related to this group theoretical picture. So there must be a way of actually implementing this group theoretical picture into this path integral. Yes?
So just related to Antony's comment about the dilatation, I think it would be the case that if you just took the null translation together with the Boost, you
mm-hmm.
would also get your AX plus B algebra, right?
Null translation with?
So take PT plus or minus PX together with the Boost. Don't add that. So you did a combination of dilatation and Boost.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a general quantum field theory, the dilatation would you wouldn't have a unitary group of dilatations unless it was like a conformal field theory. But I think you can do the same using basically just forgetting about the dilatation and using just a Boost together with null translation.
Both null translations.
But then you're losing.
Supposed to be you just pick one of them.
So you're saying that I'm getting if I instead of dilation if I use the light-like combination of translations together with the Boost, I get the same algebra. But then I'm losing this nice interpretation, right? Because indeed it's just the Boost combined with dilation, which actually gives me this nice coordinate description of the Rindle wedge.
Yeah, that's true.
The null
translation
preserves the Rindle wedge. Is that relevant or not? Is that the same thing? Maybe that's the same. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, that was an ingredient of this derivation as well. Yeah. The null translation was already there. So.
Yeah. It was.
Yeah,
yes.
So
that's true.
Was it?
So it's not an objection.
Is it a worry? Is it a worry that doesn't preserve the Rindler wedge?
Sorry, I couldn't.
It doesn't take the Rindler wedge into itself.
The translation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I'm using this. You know, that's why I'm using the grouping. This. I start with while with this Y Poincaré, and I'm grouping it into two pieces, which are one is the symmetry, it's a translation of Minkowski, and one is a kind of a translation of Rindler.
Can one also understand this in the Euclidean? Because R, D over DR is not the D over DR is not the Hermitian operator on the.
What is D over DR?
Like, if you use coordinates in the plane,
mm-hmm.
pi and R,
mm-hmm.
then D over DR is not the Hermitian operator.
But what is D over DR? I never used anything like D over DR.
But it is like your RD over DR would be like your limitation.
Oh yeah, but it's a nice operator. You're acting on a state, you know, on a positive state. So this is the representation theory. So everything. So the if I go back. So I started with representation theory. Right? Is it the right? Yeah, this is the representation theory. So I started with this representation theory, which is defined on the half line, and then these guys are this guy and this guy are nice self-adjoint or Hermitian operators. The measure is not trivial.
And that's again the point.
Yes.
Which representation are you allowing? But you have to specify an inner product essentially.
Yeah.
Talk about Hermitism.
Yeah.
Okay, since we're getting into the details of, I had a question about, so you're saying that R is self-adjoint? There was something that just reminded me of detail where you applied E to an omega state and you got omega minus I. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So how do I make
Let me, you know, you're in a better shape.
You're supposed to be real, so I'm...
More surprisingly, the P is...
Pardon?
P is self-adjoint.
You mean this one?
R is a little tip.
So P is self-adjoint, but R is not.
No, it's more surprising. Yeah. But if you look above, then R is a notation operator, and it's a very defined on R plus. Usually you have to work hard to make the translation operator very defined on the half line.
This one.
P. This P.
P is a translation operator, which is, so this is the representation of P on the states, which are on the half-line states, but they are momentum states.
P is multiplication on the half-line, right? That should be fine.
Yeah, but if you translate it, it's a half-line in K-space.
It's only half-line in the K-space. So this is the representation is, that this basic representation I started with is the representation of, it is the action on the positive energy states, physical terms.
Any more questions or comments? Jorik is here until tomorrow, so you can still discuss questions. So let's thank him again for his nice talk.
Yep.